Parenting's hard, you don't know what to do. You're blaming your kids, but it's probably you. You love your kids and that you can trust. Just remember your kids don't suck.
Welcome to Your Kids Don't Suck, cultivating closeness with your children through non-coercive conscious parenting. We're your hosts, Kara Tedstone and Rathia Lee. Let's dive in and grow together. All right, welcome back to Your Kids Don't Suck, where we are constantly on the path to sucking less and less so we can get closer to our children. Thank you for being here with us and being on the same path. It's a hell of a ride. We're here today with a guest. So excited. It's me and Rathia Lee, and I'm Kara Tedstone, and Rathia and I are both therapists, and we are here to talk to our guest, Ash. Ash became like almost like a friend to us. I feel like, Ash, I've only spoken to you a couple times now, and I'm like, we're just buddies. We're buddies. Ash, you met Rathia, right? You did a call, or can you tell us your story of how you met us? And then you can introduce yourself a little bit.
Sure. Well, in the depths of postpartum, when I was just glued to my screen on TikTok, breastfeeding for countless hours on end, I found Rathia, and I was just like so in love with her and her work, and I connected so deeply to the, you know, the core message, and yeah, reached out and was like, I love you. I think this connects totally with what I'm up to. And that's sort of how we first met.
Yeah, I love that. And that's like me too. I just DM'd Rathia one day and was like, hey, I'm obsessed with you and we're gonna be friends now. And so let's do a podcast maybe. And Rathia was like, okay. And now we're all here being besties, and it's the best thing ever. Ash, you and I talked for a long time once. We obviously connected through Rathia. You had talked and then we talked, and I was obsessed with you and I was obsessed with what you're doing. Will you tell us that you're doing a PhD, you're in the middle of it, right? Or you're soon to complete it, but you also have a little one, you're a parent too. And so how does that all relate? Tell us a little bit about your story.
Sure. So my name is Ash Lowenthal. I have my partner and I have a 2.5-year-old son named Raffi. We are from the suburbs of Montreal, which is unceded Ganyakahaga territory, so or Mohawk. And yeah, I'm in my 6th year of my PhD, which is kind of cuckoo to say, but finally kind of in the very last leg. So finishing up data analysis, writing up my thesis, and basically what my work is about is studying the liberatory potential of trauma-informed care and how and whether it can really transform dynamics of power between adults and kids. And so that's why I felt like so much so connected to what you guys are all up to, because I feel like I'm doing what you're doing with parents, but in a kind of more professionalized contexts. So schools and child protection, healthcare, and stuff like that. So how did I get here? I really connected with Rathia's story because I also come from a family that has been deeply scarred by intergenerational trauma and internalized childism. And I basically ever since I moved out, since I was 18, my path has been all about kind of healing and unlearning from my experiences as a kid. And one of the things that has helped me so much is sort of finding my people and joining struggles like, you know, I got involved in activism when I was really young. And I think that really helped me kind of put all the pieces together, that my experiences in my family are connected to these sort of broader injustices. And
First of all, I'm sorry that your history is similar to mine. I wish that wasn't true for either one of us. And, you know, I'm always so moved when people find a way to have a voice after a childhood like that. So I really want to hear more about what you're writing.
Sure.
I mean, we talked about you even maybe reading. I don't know. Did you prepare that? We talked about you maybe reading little sections of it.
I have a ton prepared. I could really talk for like 5 hours about childism and trauma-informed care and all this stuff. And I mean, maybe I'll talk a little bit about kind of first what got me into the PhD. So I was working First off, before the PhD, I got interested in trauma-informed care because I had a job working in a youth homeless shelter. And sort of my first day on the floor, the person that was supposed to be training me was the way he trained me was like, listen, you got to show these kids who's boss or they're going to walk all over you. And so I got into so many power struggles that escalated to like calling the police. And I was just like, okay, this is really fucked up and not how I want to be working with kids. And like around that time, trauma-informed care was just kind of, starting to come on the scene. And I really saw it as like a really, it had potential to really challenge this way of practicing with young people. So then I got my master's in social work, and one of the jobs I had was I was a mental health clinician, and I worked with kids who were on probation, and then I also ran a an attachment-based kind of therapy group for parents who had mental health diagnosis. And what I was seeing in both these different contexts was parents would come to me and be like, you gotta fix my kid. Like, they're such a problem. Here you go. And then I'd be like, so, like, what have you tried? Like, what's your relationship like? And they'd be like, me? Why are we talking about me? And they'd be like, I've tried everything. And then we talked about what that was. And it was basically just like turning the volume up on like coerciveness. And like, I've gotten more and more coerciive and it's not working. And I'm like, okay. And I think so that's when I was like, all right, I wanted to get out of the clinical space and I wanted to kind of get involved in more like macro level change. And that's when I started on the PhD. And I have basically spent the last 6 years kind of feeling around the scholarship and like trying to find the trauma-informed care scholars who are saying really radical stuff, because that's one thing about trauma-informed care is that it's become a really large movement, just like any other movement, like feminism. There are like folks who are super radical and want to really, squash patriarchy at its roots. And then there are folks who are like, feminism, it's cute. Like, I'll apply it in ways that feel fun and don't challenge anything fundamentally about the status quo. And it's kind of the same thing with trauma-informed care. One of the things I wanted to say about and just sort of kind of explain what it is, fundamentally, it's about fostering safety, because we know that as humans, we have a hard time learning and growing and connecting when we feel threatened or we're exposed to toxic stress. And so over time, a set of core principles, which again shift and change depending on the context, have emerged, but a lot of them are like really similar to the principles of non-coercive and collaborative parent. Like the number one principle in trauma-informed care is collaboration, choice, transparency, mutual aid and equity and things like that. And I wanted to read this quote with you because when I see folks who are kind of using the concept of trauma-informed care to talk about something that's like super watered down and really just kind of rebranding more of the same, I read this quote from the folks who first coined the term in 2001 in a publication called Using Trauma Theory to Design Service Systems. And so they say, regrettably, a relationship with a powerful authority figure who controls all of the resources and whose opinions and wishes take priority over one's own is tragically reminiscent of the abuse dynamic in which the trauma survivor was forced to accept an unequal relationship in order to avoid even worse treatment. The traditional service relationship replicates some of the most damaging dynamics of childhood trauma. So that's what I kind of fall back on to really promote that trauma-informed care is inherently about ch challenging power and challenging dynamics of domination and oppression that play out, in society at large, but really are also we embody in our most intimate relationships and also in our relationships between service providers and service users in so many different contexts. So.
I mean, that quote really sums it up. It's really also interesting that that's from 2001. I mean, we all know that change is takes forever. It's like a billion years, right, for anything to like marginally change. But 2001, you know,
it takes a long time, unfortunately.
Takes freaking,
And
I mean, yeah.
there's so much backlash.
Yeah, that's the other thing. You know, you're speaking such truth, like clearly to me. I mean, yeah, this is like, I always try to remind people, like, this isn't just us sitting here kind of brainstorming out of our minds. Like, this is like science. Like, there's literature, there's research. Like, this is like real truth. This is like evidence-based stuff we're talking about, we're referencing. But yet, you know, all I hear is the backlash. Like, when people are sharing this with me, like, I'm like, oh my God, you're so right. Keep talking. And I also hear that voice of like, no, this is insane. This is insanity. You're gonna create brats. What about behaviorism? What about conditioning? How are they gonna learn?
There's also the narrative now that everybody has that this generation coming up is a bunch of entitled
Yeah,
kids
snowflakes.
who got everything they wanted, and now there's demanding brats, even as college kids, which is wrong.
Totally. Yeah, like where's the resiliency? Like, where's, you know, the ability to like grin and bear it and like push through? We all have to do things we don't want to do sometimes. Like,
Yeah.
where is that?
Oh my gosh. So I
Yeah.
have something I think not exciting, but I'm very passionate about or about this exact topic, which is that like folks have a sense that, or this, I think I've bought into the myth that parenting has become too nurturing and has shifted over the last few decades, and it has. And I got the honor to speak with Dr. Joan Durant, who was like one of the kind of, first advocates to say like in scientific and academic circles to be like, hey guys, I think we should really talk about corporal punishment, and I really don't think this is actually in the best interests of kids. And she has been like instrumental in ending corporal punishment kind of around the world, or not ending, but like reducing the rates and getting it like creating actual legal bans. So there's many countries around the world who have made it illegal to use corporal punishment. Canada is not one of them. We still have in Section 43 of our criminal code, it is still legal to hit your kids for disciplinary purposes. But one of the things that was like really amazing talking to her was that, even though our kind of tolerance as a society for like very harsh corporal punishment has kind of gone down, it's really just shifted to more emotional forms of punishment and different types of control. And there's actual science that's sort of backing this and saying that like parents' level of control they have over their kids has actually increased. So there's this really cool article I wanted to talk to you guys about. That is a sort of a longitudinal kind of meta-analysis of young people and their parents from like 1989. Let me look up the exact date. I think like 1989 to, I want, yeah, 2019. And the levels of control have increased, and control around like increasing parental expectations, increasing criticism. And what the interesting thing that I think that the work that they've done is like connecting it to the wider social context. So, because of increasing income inequality, because of increasing competitiveness, individualism, parents see it as their roles. Like, if my kid is going to have access to the same sort of quality of life, standard of living that I have, I have to push them to excel academically. I have to push them to excel in their extracurriculars, and I have to have these like super high standards and shame them and judge them if they're not just like constantly excelling and using every minute of their life to do resume building. And obviously, this is not like everyone, but it is a general trend in sort of the parenting styles. And I think, and I totally, it resonates with me that like it is for sure connected to this sort of wider social context. And so even though our kids aren't getting hit, they're not getting punished as harshly as maybe they have before. And so people have all these, thoughts about how these generations are spoiled, but actually they're just like deeply wounded and have so many struggles with like perfectionism and feeling any sort of sense of self-efficacy because their parents are so anxious and are kind of breathing down their necks, and they don't get a chance to just sort of like make mistakes, mess up, go out on their own, do their own thing. And so like they're coming in with like different wounds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's so interesting that you're sharing, you know, it would be great to Ash to put some of these in the show notes if you maybe you can email me
Yep.
and I'll do that. But what's really cool is, you know, it echoes what we as therapists who work with families experience every day. So it's like yelling into the void, being like, please, guys, listen, listen. I'm telling you, I see this every day with these parents of especially like young adults. Like that's a lot of who I work with is like parents of young adults who are my clients, who I then bring in the parents to help them support their kid relationally. And what it is like helicopter, hyperactive, over-involved parents who are obsessed with their kids' performance. And the kids often shut down totally in so many ways. Like they're truly shut down from the ability to perform anymore. They get exhausted. They get completely incapable of like existing anymore. They're in deep depression. And this is the trend. Like this is like what happens. Like this is what I see day in, day out. This is the results of what you're talking about across the research. I mean, 20 years of research, 30 years of research. I can't remember what dates you said. Decades. You know, we're talking about decades. It's clear in the research. It's also clear when you speak to families that this is what's happening, that kids can't do it anymore. They're so deeply wounded from this like pressure to perform.
And I'm so annoyed at the sort of general interpretation of this. Like, there was recently, I think it was like, I don't, this something, not attorney general, but maybe the surgeon general or some big health official in the US was like, parenting is making people sick. And there's been all these CBC, which is our kind of NPR, I guess, in Canada. So many CBC articles about like gentle parenting and is it too much on parents and whatnot. And it's like, and people are like, well, parents are spending like way too much time with their kids. But it's like, it's not like that they are spending too much time. It's like the quality of the time and the focus of the time and the focus of the time being on control and achievement and,
And structure, and even structure, like structured activities. Like that's what, you know, I'm in Toronto. A lot, the majority of parents that we know are really into structured activities for their kids. So there's daycare, there's preschool, there's things outside, there's gymnastics, there's soccer, there's hockey, there's t-ball, there's structured birthday parties, there's play dates. There's just no room for these toddlers and babies to breathe. There's also this just mindset shift that I have, which is like, whoa, what are we doing? That people, I'm telling you, and I don't know about you, Ash, but like people cannot relate. They're inside of the pressure constantly to push their kid to the next milestone and to the next achievement. And if you aren't doing that, you are perceived as being a lazy and neglectful parent.
And one thing I will say is that like I want to have like I want to take a moment, I'm going to take a breath and like have compassion for all the parents who feel like totally stuck inside of this sort of like anxiety cycle of like I want my kid to be okay and I feel like this is my only way that I can sort of try and guarantee their future survival and success. And like one of the things, so I'll just talk a little bit about my actual qualitative research, and I promise we'll come back around to this. But so one of the parts of my thesis is to study this, you know, very long-term implementation project of trauma-informed care in residential care centers. So these are places in Quebec, where kids who can't live at home for either child protection reasons, or some of the units I studied were also units where kids were housed or detained when they're sort of involved with youth justice, so have committed a crime. Anywho, this is like this organization has been trying to implement trauma-informed care over the last 10 years, and there is certainly backlash and resistance. Like, I'm not going to deny that. That's certainly something I encountered when I was doing my research. However, the buy-in is there. Folks, like I would say the overwhelming majority of folks are like the same way Raytheon was like, this is water to me. Like the staff were like, yes, like we, and a lot of those folks felt validated that the way they've been wanting to practice is what science says, you know, is the best way to practice and is going to honor children's developmental needs. The problem is that like knowing something intellectually and embodying it is two completely different things. And the residential care kind of institution or agency is not a setting that is conducive to like how much time it takes to like create those collaborative, trusting relationships with the kids. how much energy it takes from the staff, how much support and training and supervision and coaching, and your own kind of therapy it takes to like be present for kids who are coming from like, the heaviest trauma like you can imagine. And so even though the staff have totally bought in, like mostly, it's they all have like all of the ones who bought in that I interviewed were all like, when I get on the floor and I'm triggered or I'm stressed or there's like nine of, because often it's like the ratios are way too high. And they all say like, I just revert back to how I was treated as a kid, how I parent, like all of those things are interrelated, right? Like the societal scripts we have for adults relating to children is going to be the same in a family, and it's going to be very, very similar in a residential care context between professionals or workers and kids, unless there's like training and unlearning and healing, and that's just not always the case. And I think it's the same with parents, that if parents don't get added support, it's going to be really, really hard to do non-coercive collaborative parenting because it does take more time. It does take more energy. You have to be reflexive. And like that stuff isn't easy. I have the privilege of being able to like just being focused on my PhD right now. So I have like, I'm flexible. I can take the extra hour it might take to get my kid to daycare in the morning because we're having a hard morning. But some parents just like don't have that luxury. And I don't think that means that there's nothing that they can do. I still think even in those very challenging circumstances, we do have some agency. But I did want to speak to that, like that sort of gap between like buy-in and then like embodiment, because it's real and it definitely is impacted by our environment and our access to resources and support.
Well, I run these support groups for parents who are trying to transition out of authoritarian practices, and usually about 12 people in a group, and they're about 6 to 8 weeks. No, they're like 8 to 10 weeks. I don't know. I've been messing around with how long they are, but it is so much about deprogramming our minds. And even though I've been doing it, my daughter, I started when she was 5, she's now almost 13. I'm still constantly having to deprogram myself. It's such hard work. Like, that is the hardest part of it. It's not actually my relationship with my child. That's not hard. The hardest part is all the places where I'm stuck and scared and conditioned to revert. Like, you use the word revert. I'm conditioned to revert, and I have to constantly be reminding myself to stop, breathe, pause, evaluate before I talk, bite my tongue, see her as human, blah, 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 all of that. And the only reason I keep doing it as a rigorous practice is because the love that happens is so profound and unmistakable.
Yeah, I feel the same way. Like just this morning, I can't remember what he was doing, but like I think he was like hitting me in the head with like this like shower. Anyway, this what is it called? Like it's like a wood, there's it's like a loofah with a wooden handle on it. Anyway, he was like, and it has a string on it. So he was kind of whipping it around. And obviously, like he was having fun exploring what this loofah with a wooden handle could do and how cool it is to swing it around, and like hit me in the head by accident 2 different times. And then I was like, I could, and then I felt in the moment like I responded how I was probably responded to as a kid. 'Cause like I literally feel like I take on sort of like this other person that I don't feel like I am in that moment. I was like, oh, and I sort of yanked it away from him. I was like, whoa, okay. It's not okay that mommy took that out of your hand. Are you okay? I'm sorry, and things like that. But like, if this that shit happens to me all the time, and it's hard, and I feel really bad about it, because like, I even tell we talk about all the time, like, how if he wants his friend's toy, not to pull it out of his hand, and then here I am pulling it out of his hand, right? And I'm like, that wasn't okay. That's not what we're supposed to be doing when we want something that someone else has, right? So yeah, I'm also constantly reverting back to like old habits. And
I mean, it's it's the same work as undoing racism, undoing misogyny. It's the same work. undoing all the isms.
But what I find is that, like, and there's some really cool work happening, actually. There's a new book that just got published, Implementing Trauma and Violence-Informed Care, which is sort of a more radical branch of the trauma-informed care movement that's recognizing that for any person or organization to say they're doing something that's trauma-informed, they're going to have to address structural violence.
Oh,
And
great.
in the whole book, there's nothing like childism is sort of the least acknowledged form of oppression that I see in any sort of critical theory spaces. And so, like, I think I'm going to be the first person when I publish my paper, hopefully very soon, on my thesis that, like, that addresses that connection between, like, if we want to be doing trauma-informed care with kids, like, we're gonna have to address these, like, really messed up power dynamics and really messed up beliefs. Like, something that I encountered from folks who were resistant to trauma-informed care was like, well, like, they feel totally helpless when you're like, well, maybe let's not punish. They're like, what? Like, how am I supposed, like, it's like you're taking their only tool. And like, folks have really deeply ingrained beliefs that for kids to learn and grow and develop, they need to suffer and be punished. And these are like deeply ingrained beliefs that take like so much deprogramming, like you're saying. And however, it's like not, at least in the spaces that I've encountered in critical theory and trauma-informed care, it's just like childism is totally missed as an oppression and a form of structural violence that we need to be addressing.
Whoa.
So you're saying that, like, in all the research, like, that's a difficult thing to come across?
To come across childism.
Yeah,
Oh,
like there's not a lot of emphasis on that. There's not much research on that,
it's
'cause
like
like
the most underdeveloped critical, like, form of critical theory. Like, it's like totally underdeveloped as a theory. Like, there isn't even any consensus on even the term, because for some, childism is the form of oppression, but then for others, people use childism as like the movement to end the oppression against children, kind of like feminism, where, right, like, it is the oppression,
Oh,
right?
like
And so,
Iris
like,
Rithia, remember when we had Iris on? Iris said that. She was like, I use adultism. You know, there's sort of like there's not a consensus on like how to use that term, because she was like, I feel like adultism more speaks to what I'm talking about.
yeah. And then there's like what I would say, like, to kind of, that would be more sort of in line with other ways that oppressions are named, like, for like, anti-child ageism, like anti-Black racism or anti-Indigenous racism. So like forms of, and so like, because technically it is a form of ageism, but it's very different than other forms of ageism, right? So it's like there isn't, like, it's such an underdeveloped, and again, like, even in scholarships that are, you know, well developed, there's always going to be, you know, contested terms and whatnot, but like, truly, childism is a field that is like very, it's sparse, to like say the least. And it's like, that's where I feel called to kind of, you know, add to the conversation and promote, like, yes, like, people are saying like children aren't oppressed. And so, yeah, that's where I want to add my voice.
Yeah, there's such a there's also a deep disconnect between child abuse. Like, there's a lot of research about child abuse, but then there's no connection between the structural way we treat children as a society that is abusive. It's like there's these abusive situations, and they like treat it like
Like an
they just
isolated
happen.
event.
Yeah, like they're isolated from that, the fact that it's set up for that. And the reason there's so little research on it is because we can get away with abusing children. There's no problem with that. We can just do it. It's
It's so normalized in
so
our,
easy. They can't do anything about it, and they never will be able to. And they're in their little situations where they have no voice, and you can manipulate them, and their brains will block it out too. Like, repression and dissociation is just how our bodies do it, and they won't even remember it.
And I would also argue that, like, it's encouraged, right? If we look at, like you said, Ash, it's literally in
It's in the criminal code. Article
the criminal
43
code.
says that, like, teachers and parents can use, like, use force.
I mean, if
And
that's
it's
not
even, yeah.
encouragement, I don't know what is, you know? And like I was saying, like, to bring it back to like the community, like when you're outside of a group, when you're not in the group mindset of like, this is how we treat children, like me, you so clearly see how it's encouraged. Parents will be like, you have to show him, you've got to, he's got to learn. Well, they need to focus on their task. You've got to get them to the therapist where the therapist can fix the problem for you. Like, it's just encouraged. Like, parents are encouraging other parents. And of course we know it's because, like, we don't know better. When we don't know better, we can't do better. But the point is like, it's very difficult to like really feel like constantly empowered, like when you're on this path, to feel empowered day in and day out to do the work, to do the deprogramming, and like to continue to like strive. It's hard. Like, those are barriers, is what I'm trying to say. Those are barriers. When you're not in a community of people who are doing it and you're kind of thinking about it in a completely different way, it's fucking hard.
Especially if you're a survivor of families that use deeply coercive approaches like me. When I, I have this part of me that's like a rebel, and I've always been so obsessed and involved in like all the different kinds of like speaking truth to power. And yet, when I get into those situations and I'm about to say the thing, I feel deeply, deeply frightened, and so, and like all of those feelings of being a kid and like come back. And so I think like not only is childism a form the most widespread form of oppression, but it's kind of the oppression that makes all other forms of oppression more possible, because it creates a population of people who feel scared to speak up, who have trouble using their voice, who deeply want to people please, and like it just becomes hard, to say the thing and to talk about abuse, to talk about violence and things like that, and make the connection between personal experiences of family violence and how it relates to structural violence and systemic violence. And I think that like we're so used to these cultural narratives of like bad apples, right? Like, oh, it's only those parents who are, it's only happening in families where there's these bad apples, there are criminals and whatnot, and they don't see the connections. It's just like, actually, no, the core values and beliefs in our society like make it all possible, and we're kind of all complicit in that. And it's hard. Like even the ACE, like I don't know if you're aware of the ACE study, like no one ever talks about like ACE epidemic. Like people call it the ACE epidemic. So ACE standing for adverse childhood experiences. They call it an epidemic. And then no one is just making a link between an epidemic of adverse childhood experiences and, structural violence. And if they are, then they're doing it for only certain types of children. And I will agree, certain types of children are more at risk, right? Like kids living in poverty, kids, from racialized background, indigenous, right? Like queer kids, like for sure. But like all kids are exposed to childism.
I really wanted to ask you, it doesn't have to be your next question, but I really wanted to ask you, like, what is going to be, what do you envision the practical applications of your PhD to be?
That's a good question.
That's excellent work. I am conflicted about it because, there's part of me that would love to kind of, get a professorship and, teach the next up and coming, cohort of social workers how to practice with kids in a non-coercive way, and, also work clinically with parents and, start a nonprofit dedicated to challenging childism. But then also I'm like, I have a kid, and my kind of parenting is like my number one like focus in life. And I've really been exploring like unschooling him, and like, am I gonna have time to do that if I have all these sort of big projects? And I'm so, I've thought like, should I open a free school? Or like, I'm really in like the sort of visioning phase right now, and like the end of this, like finally submitting this PhD is going to be sort of closing that chapter and opening up something new that I have totally, I have lots of different ideas, but I have no idea which one I'm going to go with, because I'm sort of kind of following the rhythm of like how things are going with Rafi too. So,
So in terms of like when you're published, this will be something that other scholars can like kind of reflect on. Like, there's a lot of research that you're doing, obviously, to like Well,
encompassed in the
so
final.
the way my thesis is, and this is like boring academic details, is that so I'm doing a three article thesis, and the first article I've already actually published. It was a scoping review of every study that has been published on implementation initiatives of trauma-informed care in organizations that are serving children and youth. And so I looked at like what do these implementation initiatives look like? What are they doing? What do they involve? What are the outcomes? You know, what are
Right.
the set? You know, I looked at all of that. And so that's already published and out there. And
So what was your findings?
well, the findings were that, and one of the big ones was that like people are calling trauma-informed care implementation a very wide
A
range of
whole
things.
bunch of shit. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like,
Yeah.
for example, like a 15-minute online tutorial for
Yes.
pediatricians versus like a decades-long, multi-state, multi-agency implementation initiative that involved like training and supervision and coaching and policy change and, you know, like infrastructure change, right? And so there's a huge range of what implementation not can look like, but what people are calling implementation, because I would argue that in any implementation initiative needs to involve not only training your staff, but training them in like an ongoing way and supervising and supporting them in an ongoing way, as well as changing the policies, the protocols, the infrastructure for how you do things, because the way that our organizations are set up right now, they're not really conducive to collaborative, anti-coercive relationships between service providers and users. They're, you know, the legacies of most of our institutions are, you know, their main purpose was like social control and colonization. And so like they still deeply hold those legacies in how they're, you know, in the organizational forms. Like, but also like our organizational forms, we've inherited them from like the Industrial Revolution, and like a social service agency is structured in this like rigidly hierarchical and bureaucratic way, which in no way is conducive to like the kind of relationships and nurture and de like democratic decision making that would make any sort of trauma-informed care possible. So, yeah. And also, the finding was that these more comprehensive implementation initiatives are obviously leading to better outcomes, right? So the ones that are 15 minutes don't
Yeah.
generally last, you know.
But that's so like hard to like swallow for me, you know, seeing all this solution focused type stuff being sold and like parroted and reinforced and like sought after, purchased, like repackaged. Like, I mean, I know it sounds really like dramatic. Like it saddens me deeply. Like it's very like disheartening. It's like so fucking exhausting to like watch it all be like packaged for the consumer to like be like, hey, like here's a quick fix. So you see it inside of the system and like you see it inside of families and it's so fucking sad and disappointing. And like, yes, change is a slow process, but we have to like invest in the right places.
Yes.
And it's just really, really, really too bad that like it's kind of everywhere, this desperate will to like slap a band-aid, you know, and put the lipstick on. And
Yeah.
you go to the pediatrician and they've just seen like maybe a 10-minute video and they're kind of like that's been like the protocol. And it's like, yeah, it's really, really deeply sad. So I admire your endurance to put the research out there, to like continue to read it, to try to like establish something good, some organization, some community, collective. We have to keep chipping away. Like we really have to. Thank you so much for doing what you're doing. So important. And also just to like keep writing. And keep sharing, like, yeah, it's just like you say, there's just not enough written material.
Yeah.
And
Yeah, we're talking about that too. We're trying to get ready to write more.
yeah.
I think what you're doing with the podcast, though, I think like my partner does not read anything that is a hard, like does not read a physical book. He, if I
Right.
am like, here's a book that's cool, he'll read the audiobook. And so I think a podcast is actually more accessible and like easier to consume than written things. I feel like in academia, there's this huge pressure to like publish these journal articles that like, you know, barely anyone outside of academia or outside of our tiny little bubble of our specialty ever read. So I don't know. I think like
having a podcast is like a deeply impactful way of doing this work. And I thank
Oh.
you for having this podcast because I listen to everyone and also make my partner listen to every episode. So,
Oh, good.
yeah.
That's so great.
Are you going to try to make your thing a book?
Well, okay. That's a good question. The actual format of what I'm working towards is to publish two, like to finish the thesis, to like submit it as a thesis. I just have to write
Right.
two journal articles and then slap it kind of all together as a book. But may I'd love to one day write a book about
I see.
that like
Because there's
kind of
also, like, I don't know if you've read Ash, like Alfie Kohn's work, but you know,
yes.
he, right, like, I'm sure you have, right? Because he writes so much about, like, he references the research and, like, puts it all together. And I think you're so right that, like, a podcast and, like, including people in the conversation is such a great way to do it. But then there's also, like, all this, like, you know, on Reddit and like all these places on the internet, it's like evidence-based parenting, like science-based parenting, like here's how you have to do it. And I just always kind of reference like the emphasis on authoritative, specifically
Oh,
not authoritarian.
I have a lot to say about that.
Right. And I'm
One
sure like we should honestly do a whole episode on the three, right? There's like authoritarian, authoritative, and permissive,
of...
three
That's starting to
buzzwords.
be challenged. Like, so
Right.
I'm so happy to see that finally
Yes.
some scholars are being like, wait a minute, you know,
Yeah.
like Bom, it's Bomrand, I think that's how you pronounce their name, who came up with these four parenting styles that has been like
Right.
enshrined as like the only way to understand parenting for like decades. And finally people are like, you know, I think Bomrand was like very punitive. Like they very much saw like punitive and control as an important part of an authoritative approach. And so there are scholars who are breaking down finally these parenting styles.
Finally.
I just saw, I wanted to mention, I pulled up this paper. Did I put the authors? I did not put the authors here, but I can send it to you. You can put it in the show notes. But there are researchers out of Spain who
Yeah.
are studying, who did a study based on and looked at things like parental strictness and parental like warmth.
I
And they,
know this one. I've
yeah,
read this
don't you
one.
have you seen it?
I
And like
have.
and finally, and they called the one that was like only warmth and no strictness indulgent parenting.
Yes,
And they were the
indulgence.
kids who fared the best
Yes,
out of
yeah.
all the other kids. And like you can see this, you know, there are other research, you know, there are other papers and other studies who've also come up with this finding, but like so many studies don't like it's not they're not able to come up with that finding because they don't even create a class of
Yeah.
like, you know, parents who are not also strict and controlling. It's either authoritative, authoritarian, you know, so like
Yeah.
they're finally
I
the yeah.
What's authoritative? I never understand what that is. What is that?
As a parent, like as a parent of a young toddler, like if you Google parenting and like how to parent or like how to deal with blah 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 on Google, you will literally see the definition of authoritative parenting as like the number one result, and it will be like forms and forms and forms and like endless like articles on like how to do that, which is just like what people often refer to as gentle parenting is authoritative parenting in like that
Oh,
context. So it's literally
okay.
just like punishment and discipline and coercion and control, but it's like done with warmth or in your tone or something.
Oh,
Like, so
I
Ash, you
see.
can, I'm sure you can like elaborate, but that's how
Yes,
I
elaborate on that. I want to hear
experienced
more.
it.
Well, I mean, I think you described it really well in that it is the parenting style that has been sort of advocated by parenting experts and the parenting research for decades. And like, if you want to parent, you got to parent authoritatively, which is
Yeah.
like you got to be the leader and you got to, and you know, and but you have to be warm, but you have to have limits and
Yeah.
boundaries. And there's not a lot of discussion
Yeah.
about like, well, you know, how punitive should we be? And like, and is punishment actually effective? And so there's
And
this.
what are we controlling here? What are we controlling here? Like, for example, doing like a, you know, an authoritative approach to potty training would be something like the 3-day method where you like lock your kid inside and you have them go to the potty every like half hour and you don't let them out and you have to pee before you go and you take away their diapers forever, even if they're screaming and crying for them. Widely popular. It would be an authoritative approach
Wow.
to potty training. So it's talking about like the questions that I have when I hear about this shit is like, Well, every parent then gets permission to pick and choose what they want to control. And in the authoritative approach, as long as you're being warm, but you're being consistent, you can do whatever you want. There's no parameters for what that looks like. And everybody kind of gets to make their own judgment. And it is like, in a way, it's sort of like packaged as like a formula or an approach. But of course, everybody comes at it with their own traumas and their own experiences and their own desires and wants and values. So it looks very different from family to family. And there's like no real, I mean, well, there's zero emphasis on the child's will or autonomy or opinions or perspective, because it's all about how to control your kid at the end of the day.
One of the things that I don't see in the authoritative parenting literature is any sort of emphasis on the parent's reflexivity around like, is this limit or boundary or expectation valid at all? And I think that that's also something I saw a lot in my qualitative research of these residential care centers. Like even the most like there were some because I also studied some group homes, and some of the group homes that were like cutting edge and had smaller ratios and were more focused on mental health. Even there, they would say like, oh, we're already doing trauma-informed care a lot. The thing that was always missing was like looking inwards and being like, okay, well, what am I bringing to this? And is the thing that I'm, you know, that I'm, is the limit that I'm trying to impose here actually one that is in the best interests of the child or our relationship? Or is it just like something I need to feel control over because of my shit? And like that's like usually the missing piece for so much is like
The feedback.
questioning yourself and like bringing your all of your own baggage and like that reflexivity piece is usually the missing piece for so much of like, you know.
I mean, one of the things that has always stood out to me, like I think it was maybe on an episode that we did with Thea, we've talked about it so much too, just privately, but like talking about listening to your child's feet, like considering your child's feelings and responses to how you parent as feedback. I felt like that, like putting, like having that language, like Ruthia said it, it's like, but you are listening, like you are considering her feedback. And it's like, right, because that's what it is in this parenting paradigm, that it's not a conditional relationship, that it is like just a reciprocal thing. You're constantly putting something out there, you're getting feedback, and then you're reconsidering. And then your child learns to do the same. That's what you're modeling day in and day out. So like this authoritative, authoritarian, these approaches, like they're just top down, they're just parent to child, and there's nothing about considering your child's feedback. Actually, in those parenting paradigms, the feedback is considered them having a feeling. And so you just validate it. So you hold the boundary, you validate the feeling, and you're doing great, no
Yeah,
matter
you hold the
what.
boundary no matter what. That's right.
Well, this is covert abuse, it becomes
Yeah.
covert abuse. And then it's so weird, it's so sad how all of these like new
Yeah.
books and they're just a regurgitation of giving permission to parents to be controlling. And
Just
also,
new
I mean,
ways of, of allowing it and encouraging it. So true.
yeah, and also making it look nicer, which actually could be worse in some ways. It's like at least when you're just authoritarian, it's very clear. I don't know what it's clear about, but it's clear that you're powerless. And when you're doing it with a smile and you're saying, "I understand, sweetie. Yeah, you can cry about that." It's crazy making in a totally different way.
So freaking true.
Yeah, it's almost like kind of it's gaslighty in a way.
Yes, it's
Yeah. To
gaslighting.
be like for someone to be, you know, inhibiting your autonomy and your voice and your choice so much and to be kind of doing it with a smile and with some sort of warmth. I mean, sometimes that's hard. I mean, sometimes I have to do that with my kid. There are some things that like I can't negotiate with him. And for sure I do that, but like I could never have that as like my main approach. If anything, I have learned because no one prepared me that like, you know, collaboratively parenting with a 2-year-old has made me like an expert negotiator because that's all we do, right? Because I'm considering his feedback, you know, like we're constantly negotiating. He'll be like, well, I want to wear this thing. I'll be like, great, wear that thing, but it is a little bit cold. Like, could you pick a hat too? And okay, which hat do you want? And like offering choices. And they'll be like, okay, well, I don't want to wear a coat. And I'm like, all right, well, then maybe we can't spend too much time outside or like see how it is. You know, it's just constant
Constant.
negotiation, right? And if I was just always shutting down his preferences, his feedback, and whatever, it would just, It's just like a lot of rigidity, and I don't, and he doesn't get to practice too because he's practicing also negotiation,
Yeah.
right? And relationship and collaboration and like asking for what he wants, and then me being like, well, I don't know if I can meet you exactly there, but I can meet you here, and then be like, okay,
Yeah.
that works. And like that is all relationships, and we're practicing that together.
Oh, beautiful. It's
Wow.
freaking balm for my soul to hear you say that. Like, that is it. That is what it looks like to non-coercively parent a toddler.
My daughter's almost 13 and it becomes such a flow.
Yeah.
It really pays off in the most amazing way where we're just friends. She's like, do you want to go there? I'm like, not really. Can we go in an hour? La, la. But it's just like a friendship. It just becomes,
Right, like a
and she
team, like a
actually
team.
cares about my opinion and what I need. She cares about it because I've cared about hers. That's why.
But I also think that like people think we're crazy because our kids are so young and it's like, how the fuck do you do that?
Oh,
It's so exhausting. And it's like,
yeah.
but like think about the investment. Like think about first of all what he's learning and what you're learning about each other in this deep connected way. And then look at how that translates across the lifespan. Like then fast forward, if you continue this, we're in our later years of life, our kids are grown up and we have real long-lasting friendships with our children that are not based on like the expectations that we've set. And if our kids aren't performing well, they're kind of like shit out of luck when it comes to like spending time at the dinner table because they feel our shame and disappointment. But when you do this with your child, it's completely free. It's a free, connected friendship. Ruthie always tells me, I send her little voice notes about what, I'm up to with my kid. And she goes, buddies, you're buddies. And it's so beautiful. You can see it and feel it. And other people, if they're on the same page, they can validate that. It's you're cultivating close, connected friendships. And it does look like that day in and day out and minute to minute with a toddler. And sometimes you're going to be navigating and negotiating through a tantrum. But if that's like your go-to, then, just look at the payoff. It's so freaking beautiful.
Yeah.
I really want to tell you two a story about yesterday.
Please.
My daughter had a sleepover with one of her best friends. They like love each other. And her friend doesn't tell her parents everything or things, which is fine. I'm not going to judge that. But like, so we were sitting there and Tori said to her friend, do you want to tell my mom about the thing? And then her friend was like, no, I don't want to. And she was like, okay. And then I was like, I promise I won't tell anyone. And Tori's like, Mom, you're being pushy. She just said no. And I was like, okay, fine. And then it happened again a couple hours later. She said it again. Do you want to tell my mom now? Because her friend said, maybe I'll tell her later. And she said, how about now? Is now a good time? And she goes, I don't know. I don't know if I should do it. And I did the thing again. I said, oh, I'd love to hear. I'm happy to hear anything. And she's like, Mom, she did that again. Mom, back off. You're being pushy right now. I'm like, okay. So and then my feelings were hurt and I got triggered and I had to think through it for myself. And I was like, God, eventually when I really thought about it, I was like, I am so happy that my daughter can discern that. I was like, this is the best that she can tell an adult, you're being pushy or you're being invasive or you're coming on too strong, you're trying too hard. Like if she can see it in me, then she'll be able to see it in other people. And I turned it around for myself. And I was, even though my little ego like self was like, oh, I'm annoying. Like they hate me. My inner child is like, I suck. And I maybe I was too pushy. I'm like, all my stuff came up. But when I really like from my adult self saw her behaviors, like that's remarkable that she could say that to me.
I have moments like that too with Rafi where like recently, probably because I've been feeling under-resourced lately, but he was playing with my computer because he just wants to do what mommy's doing, right? And so he loves the little keyboard and he goes, Mommy, I'm working. And then one
Yeah.
day he was like, usually I let him do it when I like turn all my stuff off and I know he's not gonna be kind of messing with documents or whatever. But one day he kind of got into my office without me seeing and was playing around on my computer and I went, and then like he got scared, so then the mouse flew and the keyboard flew off the table, and I was like ah, and he was kind of laughing at me, and then later on he was like, Mama, you yelled, you went rapid, and he just like kind of was showing me exactly, he kind of like was mocking me, or like not mocking me, because I don't want to give him that intention, but he was showing me exactly what I did. And he was very confidently telling me, like, that's not okay. And that was a lot. And like, and you know, he's two and he already knows. He already knows without me having to tell him and punish him and control him, like what is okay behavior and what is not, you know?
Oh
And
my
like he
God.
knows that deeply, just because, like, you know, he can't always act within the confines of what is right and what is not, because he's two and his like his impulse, you know, he's impulsive and whatever, and so are adults, but like, you know, he knows. And it's so beautiful. Like Tori knows too. Like, and she can pick up on these little nuances. And that's so powerful, because that is shit that I still, you know.
I still struggle with that. I do want to just bring your attention to the words not okay, even
Let's
for
hear it.
yourself.
Okay.
Because if you tell him that what you're doing is not okay, then that is really implanting that there is a right and a wrong. And it's, you could say it's wounded or mommy's triggered. I don't know. You could think of a word that means your stuff is up, but you're not wrong for your stuff being up, so that he won't be wrong when his stuff is up.
I love that. That's really good feedback. Do
Oh, good.
you have a
Yeah,
word, Kara, for that? Like that you could say that's like
I will
some.
say things like, I will say like, that's not how I wanted to act. That's not how I wanted to show up. I'll say that. I'll say like, that didn't feel good to me, and I bet that didn't feel good to you. And so I'm working really hard to do something different next time that feels good for both of us. I'll say stuff like that a lot.
Yeah, I think that's a great way of doing it.
Right, because we can't act perfectly and they can't act perfectly. The words "it's not okay" is also a big thing that parents use all the time to be coercive. That's a big one that everybody says, that is not okay. And people say that to me when they're fighting with me, arguing with me about coercion. They'll be like, yeah, but it's not okay if my kid doesn't want to sit at the table, and it's not okay if they raise their voice at me, and it's not okay. Well, you know, there's a huge list of not okay.
Things that are not okay.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, we have to just that you have to start you have to take that off the table first. That's a lot to follow. You know, that
Yeah, and I
there's
think
a
that,
lot.
like, I don't know, I think the one of the most beautiful and like the gifts of this approach, I think, to me, is like being able to be human and mess up, and the fact that I can tell him sorry, and like right away we can when ha have repair. Like that is something I never really got with my parents. They were not able to really ever apologize or acknowledge the ways their behavior was harmful. And like it just truly feels, and it's like one of the things about this approach that I find actually kind of easy in a way, for some reason, because it's to just be able, like, whoa. Oh, that mommy yelled, you know. Did I scare you? Like, I'm really sorry, you know, like, and like that feels, I don't know, that feels like such an important part of this approach, like creating repair and acknowledging our humanness and our wounds. I don't know. I just think
Yeah.
it's
I think for
so
me, it's
important.
so healing directly to my inner kid. Like when I show up like that to my child and I apologize if I scare her, if I say something that's out of alignment and I apologize, I really feel that deep relief from my exiled parts that are like, oh my fuck, thank God. Thank God somebody's able to show up in the way that we, you know, wished so deeply for, that I can like really, really cement the parallel to my inner kid and my external child and say sorry right away. So I almost like look like I seek that out. Like after I've done something, I'm like, I like run as you know, when I realize it, it takes me a bit to come out of the trigger, but I realize and I like run in and I go, oh my God, I'm so sorry. 'Cause it's like deeply healing. Like if you can see it that way, that it, you know, most of us didn't get that as kids, and we still don't from our parents today. So we can heal directly our inner children by being that for our kids and for ourselves.
Oh, I love that,
Yeah.
Kara. And I think it's a doorway too for folks who are, you know, just learning about, you know, this approach or an alternative approach to the ones they're using, because I think it's like deeply inauthentic, and I don't think it feels good to have to pretend to be this perfect person and like you've done no harm. I think it's you have to kind of just be a little bit dissociative to pretend like you've never done any harm. But I think that like often when I was teaching, young social workers or when we were, when I was part of the trainings in the research project, I could see that that was one of the biggest barriers to first kind of buying in was being like, oh shit, the way I've been doing things could be deeply harmful. I may have harmed my own kids. I may have, it makes me think about my own childhood, but like, I feel like really seeing the whole truth and like it allows you to be whole. And I think it allows you like deeper connection with others and yourself.
It
And
does.
I think it's a really beautiful doorway in. It's a hard doorway. It's not just like, you can just prance on in. I think
You got to
you have
shove it
to
open.
confront
You got
some
to
really
fight.
scary, deep truths. But I think once you kind of accept that like I'm an imperfect human, I've harmed a lot of people, I've also been deeply harmed, and that harm is connected to larger systems of harm and the context that I'm in. I don't know. I think it's like I don't know. It's I think it's such an important. It's like I don't know. It feels like step one.
Yeah, I mean, Vivek, my mentor, always like, yeah, you're going to fuck up your kid. There is no way around that. It's going to happen. You're trying to minimize that as much as you can. You will do it though. It is going to happen.
I
That's
love
so
it when
hard.
you guys tell me that. Oh my God, it's so fucking validating. But you will do it. They're literally like, we're in this group chat and they're like, Kara, you will do it. Like, fuck, you're gonna fuck up your kid. The important thing is that you're like listening to what she says about that and showing up differently afterwards.
No matter how hard you try, you're going to, and not just by what you do and what you act and what you say, but by who you are, by how fucked up you are. You can't
Yeah.
hide that from your kids.
No.
And I think like also acknowledging that like yes, we are individuals with autonomy and sovereignty over our bodies and our choices, but we are also like we are deeply intertwined with all of the rest of our, our communities and our countries and our social, economic, and political environment. And like, you can't fully disentangle from that. Like, there's no separating yourself from the context that we live in. And so, like, no matter what, some of that is gonna come into our homes and our relationships, and we're gonna do the best we can to navigate that with like kindness and critical thought and whatever. But like it's messy out there, and it's gonna be messy in our relationships too,
So, Ash, tell us where our listeners can find you because you're so amazing and everyone should follow you everywhere you are.
Well, I'm not super active right now because I've put all those projects on hold. However, I would love to connect with anyone who's interested in connecting. So you can find me on Instagram at ash.lowenthal. Lowenthal is Lowenthal. And my email is basically the same, ash.lowenthal@gmail.com. Reach out. I would love to connect.
I also wanted to plug the research group that I'm a part of, the Canadian Consortium on Child and Youth Trauma. You can give that a little Google. We have lots of great resources online for folks. Also, we host a big event every spring called the Child and Youth Trauma Symposium. It's a conference that's been getting bigger every year. I think we had over 1,500 people last year attend from all over the world, and it's a hybrid conference, so you can join remotely, and you can also join us in person in Montreal. This year, our big keynotes are Bruce Perry and my thesis supervisor, Delphine Colin-Vézina. So, if that's of interest to you, please check that out. Yeah, that's all.
And I'll put all that in the show notes so you can talk with Ash
Oh yeah, I
because
gotta send you those
she's done.
articles that I talked about.
Yes,
Awesome.
and we'll put those in there too.
Yay!
Thank you, Ash. I hope you
Thank
have
you
a
so
wonderful
much.
day. Thank you guys. Can't
Keep
wait
up the
to.
good work.
Yeah,
Thank
you're
you. You
amazing.
too.
Okay, we'll be in touch, Ash.
Bye.
Bye.
This has been Your Kids Don't Suck. You can find me, Kara Tedstone, at www.karatedstonetherapy.com. and on Instagram at Kara Tedstone Therapy. On my website, you'll find links to recommended readings and a link to my Reparenting with Mindfulness workbook, available now on Amazon.
You can find me, Rithia Lee, at www.rithia.com. That's RYTHEA.com. There you'll find published books, articles, and music and parenting videos. Also, I'm on TikTok at Rithia Lee, on Instagram at Rithia Lee. You can book parent mentoring sessions with me through my website. And also, I have an Advice from a Loving Bitch YouTube show that helps people heal self-hatred, and that's rithia.com/advice. It is important and essential to put our voices, Rithia and Kara, in a context. We are two white, cisgendered, straight, middle-class women living with financial and societal privilege. Because of this, our perspectives are limited and do not reflect the realities of all of our listeners. This podcast will feature guests with expertise around conscious parenting who differ in race, class, abilities, sexual orientation, and histories from us, to broaden the conversation and reflect the lives of as many people as possible. 25% of the proceeds of this podcast will go to creators of color who have been mentors and influences on our work and in our growth as parents.
If you like our show, please subscribe and stay tuned for more conscious parenting advice and insights. And check out our link tree at linktr.ee/yourkidsdontsuck to donate and connect with us.